Because my grandmother was French and my grandfather was Moroccan, and they lived during colonialism, and their life was very difficult.
Welcome to Francophiles. From the French Embassy in Washington, D.C., we explore the links between the United States and France, and all the history, culture, and connection that exists between the two. I'm your host, Tracy Madigan. This is our second-to-last episode of the season. So far this season, we've featured interviews with the cast and creator of Emily in Paris, with the philosopher Bernard-Henri Lévy, with the crew from the historical series Un Village Français, and author Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie, among others. This time, a glimpse into one of the many events that the French Embassy hosts. Recently, a brilliant author named Leila Slimani was interviewed in front of a live audience here. She's a Franco-Moroccan who has not only written several critically acclaimed books, but has also been awarded the Prix Goncourt. That's the literary prize awarded to the author of the best and most imaginative prose work of the year. She won that in 2016. Among her many titles, she is now a diplomat of sorts, too. President Emmanuel Macron named her the representative for the International Organization of French-Speaking People. She sat down for a poignant heart-to-heart with political commentator and interviewer extraordinaire Simone Sanders. Together, the two discuss the need for uncomfortable conversations, pushing boundaries, and why storytelling is still one of the most powerful weapons out there. Here's their conversation.
Thank you. Well, let's get started. Thank you all for being here tonight. Leila, I'm so excited to talk to you. In hearing that introduction, you are not only a diplomat, you are famous, okay? You're a human rights advocate. You are a writer. So I want to start with talking about you as a writer. And I was so fascinated as I was researching for this conversation just last week. On May 15th, writers of the world came together at the United Nations. There was an emergency session. It was the Emergency World Voices Congress of Writers that was convened. And you were there at that session. Obviously, there are very tumultuous things happening in our world right now. Europe is watching, and the world is actively, most of the world, is actively working to help Ukraine fend off this unnecessary war being waged on them by Russia. So talk to me about that convening of those writers. And, you know, did y'all solve world peace? Did you find the answers in this convening? Tell us what went down.
Yeah, in this very difficult and very tragic context, I think that the Pan America wanted to do something. They wanted the writer to say something and to raise their voice and to express many things. And I think that what they wanted also is to do something like they did in 1939, just before the invasion of Poland. And everybody knows that it didn't prevent, of course, the invasion of Poland, and it didn't prevent the war. But the idea was just to give the opportunity to writers, and especially Ukrainian writers, because there was a delegation of Ukrainian writers who gave us a testimony about their experience in Ukraine. And, you know, there is a very famous poet that I think many of you know called Anna Akhmatova. She's a Ukrainian poet. She was born in Odessa. And I remember at the beginning of her poem, Requiem, she tells a very beautiful story. Anna Akhmatova, she experienced the worst of dictatorship and of the Soviet empire. And her son was in prison. And one day she was in front of the prison just waiting. And a lot of women were there around her, shouting, screaming, not understanding what they were doing there. And at one point, one woman looked at her and she says, she looked at me with her blue lips and she said, "Can you describe this?" And Anna Akhmatova said, "Yes, I can." And I think that's all we can do. It's nothing, but at the same time, it's everything. to describe the world, to describe just what we see. Very often we feel that we are harmless, that we can do nothing. And I think that many writers, when you are locked in your room writing, you're like, why? Why am I doing that? I'm not going to change the world. I'm not going to change anything. But at the same time, just telling a story, I'm sure, can change a lot of things, or can transform a soul, can help a soul to transform itself.
Or open people's eyes. I think what was so striking to me about one of the comments that you made at that session, you referenced the nearly 7 million people around the world, people like your grandmother who had never learned to read or write. And you said, quote, maybe the first thing we have to fight for is this fundamental right.
Yes, of course. I was born and raised in a country where a majority of women couldn't read or write. And I can tell you that when you are a child and you are the witness to that, it's something really tragic. I remember my grandmother, but also my nanny. I remember her when she saw me for the first time write my name, and she couldn't. And she lived all her life in the dark, not being able to understand the laws of her country, not being able to read the prescription of a doctor, not being able to convince or be convinced, and actually not to be able to be a real citizen and to have your rights and to fight for your rights, because you are in the dark. And, you know, after COVID, so many women, so many young girls in the world won't return to school, and they won't have an education. And a woman who is not educated is a woman who is more likely going to marry very early, or is going to be victim of aggression. And it's a woman also who will have a lot of difficulty to educate her own daughter. So it's something so important today to give an education to people. How do you want to fight against conspiracy, against fake news, against so many things that are threatening us today, if we don't give the possibility to everyone just to read and write? So today, 1 billion people in the world have difficulties just to write, to read a sentence.
1 billion.
1 billion to read a sentence. You know that in France, for instance, convicts in France, 30% of convicts in France can't read or write. 2.5 million people in France, I don't say in Morocco, in France, can't read or write. So I think that's a very, very important problem, and it's a conversation we must have. And I don't understand why, especially in Western countries, we don't have this conversation. Probably also because those people feel very humiliated, because it's very humiliating not being able to read or write. You feel that you are an outcast, that you are in the margins, and you don't want to tell anyone. That's something you're very ashamed of. And I think that we really need to fight against that today.
Layla Slimani, okay, human rights advocate, I might argue, word activist, okay? It's very, I mean, I think it's critical what you are talking about. And Tracy mentioned that I want to explore the power of storytelling. When one cannot read or write, it then inhibits their ability to tell their own story.
Absolutely. Because it, first of all, I think that it gives them the impression that it doesn't count, that they don't count, that they have no importance in this world. You know, in Morocco, for instance, it's very moving at the same time. When you are an educated person, people who are not, they always tell you, thank your mother, thank your father, because they gave you an education. And they have this admiration for people who are educated. And at the same time, as I said, it's moving, but it's sad also. I want to tell them, don't look at me as if I was like a sort of master or dominating you. I don't like this position. And yeah, so of course, it makes it very difficult for them to share their story, because what is the place of people who don't have this skill that seems so simple for us, so easy, just read or write? For us, it's something so usual. We don't even imagine what it is to live a life without having that. And of course, it's also people who are very much manipulated, because they hear, for instance, during COVID, people would come in a village and say, you know, COVID, it's given by homosexual, or it's this or that. People, they believe that because they can't go and read and inform themselves and try to understand why So that's also the big danger of not being able to read or write. It's not only that you can't tell your story, it's that you are going to believe very untrue story and very dangerous stories.
Let's talk about stories, particularly some of your stories, okay? You have chosen to write about, I talk about a lot about having uncomfortable conversations and the need to, some of the, whether we're talking about race in America or race across the globe, whether we're talking about inequality or poverty, or we're talking about the crisis of folks not being able to read and write, a food crisis, so on and so forth. We need to have these uncomfortable conversations. And you write about a number of these uncomfortable conversations people need to have. I mean, your first novel, Adele, it tackled sex addiction. Okay, your second, The Perfect Nanny, it was a gripping tale about child murder. And your latest book, In the Country of Others, tackles issues of race, identity, colonialism. Talk to me a little bit about your latest story.
First of all, about my topics, I was raised by women with a very dark imagination. My grandmother, I used to spend a lot of time at my grandmother's house in the farm, and my grandmother loved to frighten us, my sisters and I. So, you know, in Morocco, especially in this region, in Meknes, during the summer, it's very, very hot, and it was really difficult to sleep. So she would say, okay, come in my room, I will tell you a story, and then you will sleep. And she would always tell us terrible stories.
She's telling you nightmares.
Yeah, about little girls who were murdered, and about a father who would eat his own daughters. But at the same time, with my sister, we would love that. We were afraid. We had nightmares, but we were like, okay, go on. Another girl who was killed, please. And my mother was the same. My mother was very anxious, always telling us about all the bad thing that could happen. You know, I was really raised like an indoor cat. My mother was like, don't go out because you could die and people could rape you and people could kidnap you. And so I can't ride a bike. I can't drive. I can't barely swim. I can barely swim because my mother was like, oh, you're going to die. So I was always thinking that, wow, there are so many ways of dying. That's terrible. So I think that I had so many nightmares and that I was afraid of so many things that at one point I was like, yeah, I think I want to share with people because I want them to be as afraid of, as me. It's unfair that I'm the only one picturing all the time how I'm going to die and be raped and kidnapped. So I think that's why I always write about my nightmare, because I want to give them to you so I can get rid of them.
Well, one nightmare turned into a movie. So, I think you put it on the pages beautifully. I'm so interested, your recent novel, and as folks mentioned in the introduction, it's a trilogy. And so this story is the story of your grandmother. And then the next story will be the story of your parents. And the third story will be the story about you. So you're going to have to tell me about those in just a moment. But before we go there, this particular novel, the first in this trilogy, it's not only I would call it a dramatized account of your family, but you also tell the story of the Moroccan Revolution. And I find it so interesting how you've intertwined these two stories and to document a very important part, but very difficult part of history for a number of people.
Yeah, you know, in France, you have a sort of colonial literature, but it's much more about Algeria. Algeria is the center of the colonial literature, and you will find no books about Morocco, about Tunisia, or even about other countries. And I was very frustrated about that. And also, for a very long time, I wanted to write about Morocco because I was raised with this idea that European novel is universal. That an American novel is universal. When you read it, it's supposed to speak to everyone. And the truth is that when I was young, when I was 12 or 14, I was reading Faulkner or I was reading Camus, and I could identify myself to those characters. And I was like, yeah, okay, it's a universal literature. But when you are American writing about Morocco, people would say, oh, it's interesting, it's exotic, couscous and all that, thank you. Mm-hmm. But it's not universal. And that's why I wanted to write a trilogy. I wanted to write about the history of this country from colonialism to nowadays, and to show to people that, of course, this country is not just a country of camels and Corne de Gazelle and Marrakech and Riyadh. It's a very complex country with a history, with fights, with people who want to be modern, other who want to be conservative. And that's also a country that had a very, very, very fast evolution. Because if you see the life of my grandmother and my life today, it is the gap is immense. And I think that Morocco in 50 years had an evolution that many Western countries had in one century or one century and a half. And I think that it's very important now for Western people to look at countries of the South, of country of the third world, as we used to say, as countries who had also a history, and we have stories to tell. You know, I remember, this is a very bad souvenir, but I remember the day when Donald Trump spoke about Haiti, saying it's a like crap country.
Oh, yes, I was on television that day. Yes, he called it a shithole country.
And I'm going to tell you something that is very sad, but when I was a child, I thought that I was living in a shithole country because people made me think that. Because when you see all the time people who want to go out of your country, people who want to migrate, when people criticize all the time and all this, at the end, you have this idea that you come from a shithole country. And that's also why I wanted to write this trilogy, to say to all the young boys and young girls of my country that, no, it's not a shithole country. And we have a lot of things to tell and a lot of beautiful novels to write. So it's not only about speaking about colonialism, it's trying to be in a journey and trying to follow this family who is going to evolve at the same time that the country also is going to evolve.
I love that. What are we going to learn? Yes, we can clap. We can clap. Yes, it was beautiful. Yes, we have a live audience here. We want to hear you. I could listen to you talk all day, honestly. So what can we expect to see from the second part of the trilogy and then the final piece? The final piece is about you. The second piece is about your parents. I think it's probably easier to write about your parents than it is to write about yourself. No?
There's a journalist in France who asked me, is it easy to write sex scenes between your parents? And I was like, not really. It was not the best moment. And they said also, what did your family think about the novel? And I was like, they are all dead. I'm very lucky because, you know, for a novelist, it's a luck to have all your family dead because you can write a lot of things.
You can say what you want. No one to protest.
And my mother is very nice. She would never say anything. But now she said that she goes to the supermarket and people come to see her and say, oh, I didn't know about you and your husband and this sexual. Oh, wow. So, yeah, I think it's not very easy for her. So, yeah, the second part is about my parents and especially the end of the 60s and the hippie movement in Morocco, because Morocco, like many countries, was very much influenced by the hippie movement, by Marxism, and was aware of everything that was happening in the world. And my parents met the day when the first man put his feet on the moon. And my mother always says that when he said, un petit pas pour l'homme, a little step for man, a big step for humanity. I don't know how you translate it.
Yes, one small step.
Yeah, man. She always says, he was talking about me. He was talking about us. And I was like, oh, no, maybe not. But
I cannot wait to read these. Okay, let's. I want to also talk about Layla the Diplomat, because I find it very interesting that particularly this novel, again, you are writing about colonialism. It was the French, okay? It was the French. So I'm very interested in that dynamic and juxtaposition. I was reading an article, an interview that you did, and you talked about the letters that you received from people who lived during that time, who were diplomats themselves in Morocco, and said, you got it wrong. The Moroccan people, they really enjoyed this. Talk to me a little bit about that.
Yeah, one day I was in Normandy and I was presenting my book, and at the end of the conference, a man arrived and with his wife, but his wife was a little behind. She looked very shy, and he arrived and he said to me, "I want to talk to you, okay? The father of my wife," and he showed his wife like it's the father of my wife. He was in Morocco and he owned a farm, and I don't understand what you're saying in your book because everyone in Morocco loved the father of my wife. I was like, okay, good for him. And I don't understand. You're very aggressive towards French people. And I was like, no, I'm not so aggressive. And I said, you know what? Maybe the father of your wife was a very nice guy. And maybe he was loved by people who worked with him. Of course, it happened during colonialism because nothing is totally black or white. Nothing is totally good or bad. So probably there were also good people who treated the Moroccan well. I said, yeah, okay. But you know what? Colonialism was a bad thing. And in terms of philosophically, it was a bad thing. And he looked at me and he said, "Oh, who knows?" I was like, okay.
I think parts of the world would beg to differ.
End of conversation. But, you know, I have no hatred. And I've never...
Why do you feel the need to say you have no hatred? Because I would never have assumed that you had a level of hatred, but...
Because he thought I had hatred, and he thought that I was writing with a desire of revenge. Mm. And that's what I tried to tell him, that I do not have that. And you know why? Also because my grandmother was French and my grandfather was Moroccan, and they lived during colonialism and their life was very difficult. My grandmother, because she was white and she was married with an Arab, was an outcast for the French community, and all people would make fun of her because she was poor. She was living in what people used to call the bled, which is the countryside. She was living with Arabs and she was speaking Arab, and because her children looked like Arabs, and there was like mixed race children, and everyone would make fun of them because they had hair like me. And I think that my grandmother, she suffered a lot. But at the same time, this couple was extraordinary. And they always tried to make a step toward the other. I remember that my grandfather went, I was a child, my grandmother, because she comes from Alsace. Alsace is a region of the east of France where people love Christmas very much. And my grandmother, she loved Christmas very much. And in Meknès, in the countryside, it was not that easy to organize Christmas. But my grandfather, one day, he went in the countryside during the night and he stole a tree. And he brought back the tree, and it was not like a tree, a Christmas tree, it was a tree. And he put the tree in the living room, and he said to my grandmother, "I understand that in your tradition you want a tree and put some things on the tree, so I brought you a tree." And it was very nice and very moving. And my grandmother always told me this story. And when I was a child, my grandfather, who was like an Arab man, very shy, he would never speak and be very, you know, tough. He would disguise as Santa Claus. And it was very weird. And I was so afraid of Santa Claus. And he would arrive on a donkey. So he was on a donkey, and he was Santa Claus, and the donkey would stop. And my grandfather used to say that if a donkey stopped, the only way to make him move is to turn his testicles. So I would see Santa Claus turn the testicles of the donkey, and I was like, what is Santa Claus? I hate him. So that was my idea of Santa Claus. So that's what mixed culture family does, that you turn the testicles of donkeys during Christmas.
So I, in addition to hosting this very fabulous show on MSNBC, prior to that, I had a long life, even though I'm very young, in politics. And my last job in politics, I was a senior advisor and chief spokesperson to Vice President Kamala Harris. And I was with her. Yes, we can clap for the Vice President of the United States of America. She's fab. And I was with her on her last trip to France to meet with President Macron, and it was an amazing trip. I don't see the ambassador, but they rolled out the red carpet. We love the French, okay? And I was struck, though, and I'm always struck when I would travel with her, because it is the first time for so many people when they have seen a woman of color represent the United States of America. And She's the first woman, first Black woman to serve as vice president. And I, every time I travel to a different country, particularly when I worked in the federal government, I was always struck by the people of color I did not see in my counterparts. And so I'm wondering, how is it for you personally to represent France as a diplomat, as a French Moroccan woman? What does that mean to you?
You know, when I met President Macron, we had a long talk, and he made me a first proposal that I refused because as many women...
You turned down President Macron?
Yeah, but you know, as many women, when I feel that I can't do something, that I don't have the competence, I say no. You know, that's something that I think a lot of people should do when they feel that it's... they don't have the competence to do it, but anyway.
President Macron, he persisted.
Yeah, no, but you know, now the prime minister in France, who is a woman, she just said today that she did some interviews for people of the government and that she received a lot of men who were like, I'm the man for this job, I can do it. And she received a lot of women who were like, oh, no, I don't think I can do it. I'm not sure, I don't have all the skills. And so, yeah, so I turned out the first proposition. And then at the end, he said, okay, you're a writer. Your job is language. And I know that you love French language very much. You come from a country, Morocco, that is a multilingual country. And French language has still a lot of importance in my country, Morocco. Would you like to be my representative of French language? And for me, I think that I accepted also, because in my country today, there is this idea that being francophone is first, it's being a bourgeois, and then that we should not speak French anymore, that French is a colonial language, that we should forget about that. And especially the Islamists, they're very conservative in Morocco. They say, don't speak French. We have only one language, and this language is Arabic, and you should only speak that, and we have only one culture and one tradition. And I don't believe in that. I think that, yes, of course, French arrived because of colonization, but you know what? Arabic arrived also because of colonization.
Well, talk about it, Layla. That's what we call a gem, ladies and gentlemen. A gem has just been dropped.
And I hate the idea of ideologizing a language. A language is not an ideology. A language for me is poetry. It's love. It's laughing with someone. It's making love with someone. It's not about an ideology. So this is my language, and I think that a woman with my color and with my face can completely represent French language, and that you don't need to be Marie and you don't need to be blonde to represent French language. And I want also to say that to Moroccan people and to Senegalese people and to Tunisian people, to say, you can be proud. We have this language. We speak multiple languages. And the next generation, we will be multilingual, and we will travel all over the world, and we will share a lot of things. Don't believe those who say that you have only one language and who want to close the boundaries and to want to have a little life, very small, because life is big and you can meet a lot of people. Be proud of this language because it's yours and you don't have to justify yourself. Your parents fought for independence and against colonialism, but this language, it's ours as much as it is as French people.
Yes, yes, it is. I guess I'm very interested to know from you, I think around the globe, globally, the global community is dealing with the fact that so many people have lost faith in institutions. They've lost faith in their governments. They've lost faith. People do not believe that governments can work for them anymore. We're dealing with it here in the United States of America. It's happening all over Europe. It's happening across the globe. And I'm wondering, you strike me. I just met you, okay? But you strike me as a person that believes in the power of institutions, that believes in our participation, that it can change things. I'm wondering, what is your message to people out there that say, I don't really know if the government is for me. I don't really know if I believe in this whole systems thing.
You know, I would never judge them, and I would never tell them that they are stupid not to believe in it, or that they are wrong, because I can completely understand why some people wouldn't believe in institutions, because we are not all in the same place, and we don't have all the same privilege and the same chance in life. I'm very, very aware, and I have always been, of how lucky I am. I was born in a family where I was educated. When I had the possibility to travel, to study in France, and to do whatever I wanted with my life. And of course, my vision of institution, because I understand them, because I can analyze them, is very different from someone for who the institutions are so far, and people are speaking in a language that they don't understand, that they can even feel is despising them. So I would never judge them. I think that maybe I would shut up if someone says that to me, and I would say, okay, explain me why. I want to understand. And sometimes the best way is not to try to convince people that you're right, but try to understand why people in front of you don't believe the same as you. So I think that if someone like this was in front of me, I will buy him a drink and tell him, okay, let's have a discussion. I want to understand why you lost trust in the institution, because it comes from somewhere.
The art of uncomfortable conversations. Yes, yes, yes. Leila Slimani, thank you for such a rousing conversation.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you. And thank you all for being here.
Thank you, Simone.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening. We'd like to hear from you. Let us know what you think of the show and who you'd like to hear us talk to. And please subscribe and rate this podcast. That way, more people will hear about it. Our podcast is produced by me, Tracy Madigan. Our editorial team is Pascal Confavreux, Baudouin Carrard, Pierre Léonard, and Susanna Autier. Our technical team is Nasrin Mirza and Patrick Nazaire. Thank you for listening. Au revoir.